Eat, Drink, Indie Radio is powered by EatDrinkIndie.com. Eat local. Drink local. Eat, Drink, Indie. Welcome to Eat, Drink, Indie Radio on WFYI HD2 The Point. I'm your host, Jolene Ketzenberger. This week on Eat, Drink, Indie Radio, we go inside the candy kitchen at Newfangled Confections in Indianapolis to talk with owner Carrie Abbott. Carrie created the popular Friddle candy, and the product line has grown recently to include a chocolate-covered version. I stopped in to talk with her back in December, but the busy candy-making season keeps on going into February and beyond. Carrie will have her Friddle candy at the upcoming Fantastic Food Fest, and she tells us how the whole candy-making company got started. We'll also talk today about urban farming, but not the kind that takes place outdoors. We go inside this week to hear about two different methods of indoor farming. We'll hear from John Shope of Falling Water Farm about aquaponic agriculture, raising fish that then provide nutrient-rich water to feed herbs and greens. And we'll talk with Chad Brandenburg of Roca Farms, where plants grow vertically in rows of towers, all inside a former grocery store building on Indianapolis' east side. So stay with us for more here on Eat, Drink, Indie Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. Here we are in late January with February and Valentine's Day right around the corner, so it seems appropriate to talk about candy. When I stopped in at Newfangled Confections in Indianapolis back in December, owner Carrie Abbott filled us in on what goes on in a candy kitchen, what's new with her popular Friddle candy, there's a chocolate-covered version now, and how the whole candy-making company got started. So tell me what it's like in a candy production facility at Christmas time.
It's a little bit crazy. It actually starts around Halloween. So for Indiana, the second it gets cold, people start thinking sugar and treats and gifts and indulgences for themselves because they deserve it because they're busy. So it starts pretty early. As soon as you see the stores change over their holiday sets is exactly when we get busy. And then now we're mid-December, we're right in the thick of it. And then we finish up about next week.
Oh, wow. So what is going on in the middle of December? Are you still making candies? Are you wrapping? What are you doing this time of year?
This time of year, we're having our final shows. That's where we sell direct to the consumer. But then in a couple of days, it will go back to supplying all the retailers. So stores like Homespun and the grocery stores, they will be doing their next set of refill candy. So they'll want a lot of candy right before Thanksgiving. And then the week or 10 days before Christmas, actually, it happens all again. So now we switch into kind of wholesale mode where we supply, deliver, make candy for them.
So what kind of numbers are we talking about? Do you have figures on, how much Friddle gets made, or how many pralines get made, or spicy nuts and that sort of thing?
Well, our local favorites like the pralines for the yachts, we usually make a few hundred of those a week. But if we do a show like tonight, I mean, we'll take 300 or 400 just for that show. If it's a multi-day, it's easy to sell 500 or 600 in a day or two. That's just the to-go, walk-out-the-door treat. Pralines aren't meant to be gifts, so that's just what we do there. Spicy nuts, those do really well in the bulk, and that's just people love the flavor, so they just want more of them. In terms of the Friddle, it's really hard to say, but any one store, they're usually buying around 100 boxes at a time. It just depends on the store. I mean, they don't sell them in a week, and like Kroger, for instance, on 116th Street, we have, three, boom, 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 Allisonville, Cumberland, and then somewhere else, but Oleo. So it's like right down the road from each other is more Frittle. So anyway, so those stores around now, they'll order anywhere from, you know, the boutiques, maybe 30, 40 boxes. You know, a place like Homespun would probably bring in more like 150 boxes. And you just never know. Somebody might see it on TV or hear it here, and they just go in and wipe out the whole shelf.
So you're constantly making more all the way up through this time of year, I bet.
It was definitely that way in the beginning. This is our fifth year in business, so we've just learned how to be more kind on our schedules. Let's put it this way. If we have a 9 or 10 hour shift here, it's filled with just busy odds and ends. We try not to be making candy up to the last second. If you see it here, it's because we've already made it and packaged it. But for instance, today and yesterday, it's strictly putting together like this new product we have. There's no faster way than putting paper fill and then putting the products and then, you know, heat sealing a basket wrap. There's just no better way than, or faster way to do it that way. So we get all the items in, and then that's basically what we're doing this week.
So this is all packed by hand. This is all a handmade, completely a handmade shop.
Yeah, that's right. So handcraft candy, but yes, everything is hand filled. I mean, I'd love $1 million candy filler into the little 4 ounce bags, but it's fun. I mean, we get to jump in and help each other. It's just kind of something about small business is really everybody does everything. Now, some of us are better than others at certain tasks, but yeah, it's like we're going through something together in the holidays, but it is all handmade and hand done.
Well, now talk a little bit about that, about the point of it being handmade and locally crafted and that sort of thing, because that seems like that's integral, you know, to what you do.
Yeah, I mean, it starts. I had three goals when I started Newfangled Confections, and Frittle is one of our products. But I really had three goals. One, I wanted it to be, additional income for the family to have a job, mm-hmm. right? And then also, but by creating a business, also have community ties to both the neighborhood, to other female business owners, to other startup food consumer good items. And that was the second goal. And the third, providing jobs. I mean, it's really important. I mean, there are certain things, like we're not a chocolatier, but I'll use this for instance. I could get a $10,000 temper. You know, I'm just throwing out a number. But when I know that we can work with our group and on a seasonal basis, and I can teach a couple people how to hand temper chocolate, and that's how I learned at Ivy Tech, I mean, that's amazing to me. You know, and again, not being a chocolatier, but we can then have chocolate items. You know, we're a wholesale for someone's chocolate bacon. I'm sure we've talked about that before. But, you know, it doesn't make sense for me to buy a temper. But I can teach a person or two how to hand temper to exact degrees. You know, you melt it, you bring it back up, you melt it again, and then you keep it on the heat, off the heat, just back and forth. And it just fills my heart with joy, honestly, that I can teach those kinds of skills and that we can have a good time and that they can get a check and then I have great help.
So it really is community focused, you know, and I'm thinking that people might not imagine, you know, a candy maker, that the ripples go out that far, you know, into the community.
Yes, very community focused. And I don't know if this is exactly selfish, but for sure, I mean, I just have always wanted a business, and I take the role very seriously about leading other, young women and sometimes young men at shows. Of just this is how business is done, and this is the attention to detail. And then when people mess up, this is how you talk to one another. And if you have something you want to air, this is how you air it, and this is how you treat each other. It's so important to me. So maybe like a micro community. It's not just in food or in confections, which we all love each other, or in St. Joe neighborhood downtown or Mass Ave. It really is like just inside these four walls. How do we treat each other? How do we work? I mean, I know they don't want a package for the rest of their life or hand-tempered chocolate. And, you know, in all industries, you know, we call them lifers, people who just love this and want to do this forever. But it really is, I want it to have a ripple effect in their family, at their churches, at their, you know, whatever it is that they're interested in, where they spend time outside of the kitchen.
So it just is, seems like a very supportive model, you know, for a business. Did you have that in mind when you said, you know, you had those three goals, you know? Did you have that type of business for sure, that that's what you wanted?
I think it progressed into that because I was faced with situations in having a small business where I was challenged and realized I needed to be more supportive, you know, because you have this dream and you think everybody thinks the dream is the same as the way you think it to be. So it's definitely challenging. I mean, owning your own business in small business and in food and it being seasonal. So I think it became more supportive in just my own growth and being a business owner.
Well, you mentioned seasonal, and here we are, you know, obviously right in the middle of the holiday season. What kinds of things are you packing up? You have people behind us that are packing gift boxes and that sort of thing. What sort of things are coming out of the Newfangled Confections kitchen at this time of year?
Well, we've had three, so I'll just remind you, this is so funny, three products in 5 years. So I was given advice a long time ago. I promise I'll answer your question. It's just the Friddle is our, you know, signature candy. So we always have Friddle going. The sweet and spicy nuts and the pralines. I would love to say every single year we come out with these like 12 really fruity, chewy, colorful candy. Those are my favorites. But doing just nostalgic, handmade, kind of updated grandma candies. Honestly, we wait till late summer and just kind of decide, what do we want to try this year? And so this year, we're doing Pecan Divinity, and that will only be available through us in Homespun down on Mass Ave. And then that's just a southern kind of marshmallowy meringue type candy. And then people have been waiting it for years, waiting for chocolate Friddle for years. So it's a milk chocolate. Now it's milk chocolate covered Friddle, which is a fudge meets brittle Friddle. And we'll offer that in little half-pound boxes. And then the last, we decided to do this collaboration basket. We've always wanted to do this with other awesome confectioners in town, and that's Elizabeth at Best Chocolate in Town. She has white-coated, chocolated, is that a word? Just Pop-Ins, white chocolate, peanut butter popcorn. And then they sprinkle it with Friddle. So it's
My goodness. Okay, now that's an awesome idea.
Yeah, and that's just one product in the basket. I don't know how much time you have here. But the one product in the basket is a brand new exclusive Just Pop-In popcorn with Friddle that you can only get through our peanut lovers basket. And we call it that because we did a peanut divinity. We did a chocolate-covered Friddle, a Friddle-flavored Just Pop-In popcorn. And then lastly, we used our favorite flavor of Be Happy peanut butter, which is the honey roasted handmade peanut butter. And that's their Dream Big that has the pretzels and the white chocolate chips.
Oh my goodness. So that's one of the baskets that's available this year, right? So do you have, are there other baskets?
Yeah, we have our traditional, I call them gratitude gift sets, right? Buy it, give it. Show gratitude with food. But we have those online. And then this one actually just was released this morning, the peanut.
Oh, my gosh.
Peanut Lovers gift basket. It's available online.
Oh, my goodness. So this is brand new. So yeah. This is fun. So this is brand new for the holiday season. How long does your holiday season go? Does Christmas just morph right into Valentine's Day?
It kind of does. I mean, there is definitely a dip and people get oversweeted. I love all these extra words we're making up. Maybe not you, but me. I mean, people, it's actually hard to believe that, you know, how we're going to feel at the end of Christmas, that people are ready to do it in another 6 weeks. But they are. We aren't traditionally a heavy Valentine business because chocolate really owns that category on a one-day event. But people do love sweets. So our wholesalers that we provide will do very well with the Friddle, and now we'll have chocolate Friddle for them.
We've been talking with Carrie Abbott of Newfangled Confections. We'll be right back with more on how the company started here on Eat, Drink, Indie Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org.
We are talking today with Carrie Abbott of Newfangled Confections, maker of the popular Friddle candy, and I wanted to hear about how the company started. Carrie tells us how Friddle came about, how it got its name, and how Newfangled Confections has grown.
Tell me how Friddle came about. You know, it's a fun word, you know, fudge and brittle. So tell me kind of the backstory.
I have just classically trained with a pastry baking degree, and I've always been in hospitality and travel and tourism. And one of the last jobs I had, I had young children, and it was about 8 years ago, I started a catering company with a well-known chef here in Indianapolis, Micah Frank, and we were doing these high-end catering events. And then for the next 3 years, I just kind of had this itch to do something more product-related, and maybe it's because it seemed easier. Catering is such hard work. I didn't know like packing a truck would be part of, you know, my skill set. But the last year in that catering business, we were starting to make these little treats just as a hospitality thank you for your business giveaway. You know what I mean? Not giveaway, but hospitality treat. And then we did this really special wedding that was held downtown. And that was just right at the beginning of Dessert Bites about 5 or 6 years ago. I mean, maybe not, but people were doing more of a variety than your traditional cake. And we were kind of vague, and we just said peanut butter and chocolate. And that was the bite. And so, as by way of background, is I made a version of Friddle based on a Reese's cup, but I made it a little bit crispier, and then we half dipped it in chocolate. And then there were some left over and gave them away, and people were freaking out.
Oh my goodness. So they got to sample the very first thing. So what, a little bit more about the reaction?
They loved it. It's come full circle, right? We started with chocolate covered Friddle, and then but now we're back to chocolate covered Friddle. But yeah, people were absolutely loving it. It's so, you know, candy anyway is very nostalgic. You know, there's just reminds you of a simpler time. And so, I mean, really, is there anything more nostalgic than Reese's Cup? But, it's just people really just, it reminded them of a Butterfinger. It reminded them of Reese's Cup. I've been told everything. Zagnut on our coconut Friddle. The peanut logs on the coconut Friddle. It's just like any combination of these 2, 3, 4 ingredients, it reminds people of something that they had when times were easy.
So the actual product, the Friddle product, how did the evolution of that go? You know, you had the prototype, maybe the people were trying. What did you have to do to that to get it to where it became? Was it lots of work? Was it an easy process? How much did it take to get it to where you wanted it?
So the original product was soft. It was very soft. It was delicious. It's wonderful with a light crisp. But I knew I had to change it for the packaging. So you didn't want the clear cellophane bag inside of the signature box to be all kind of gummy. I didn't want it to be in a slightly warm room and now it's falling to the bottom. I'm sorry if you did accidentally receive something like that. We were testing. But so the evolution of the product is it started out really soft and delicious, and then I just kept testing the recipe to harden it just enough till it's like, okay, we don't want a hard candy, but it'll stay clean in the bag. It'll just look signature, look beautiful. And that was a product I knew I could replicate a million times. And that's kind of, well, that's how it came about.
So that's where you got it to that point, and you said, this is it. This is Friddle. So tell me about coming up with the name of it, because it's a fun name.
Yeah, it is a fun name, and my friend Matt will love that I'm giving him a shout out. I'm just going to call him Matt. But honestly, it was a whiteboard session. I'd been giving away the candy for several months, and believe it or not, it wasn't always in a craft box. And I don't know if you remember, I used to use those like color tabs, so painstaking. And we sealed it with these like really fun color tabs. It was always in a bag. It was always in that box. But we did just a whiteboard, just hanging out in my kitchen. It's like, well, it's like fudge. It's like, and brudge never worked. And they were like, and then we thought of all the signature names, but we didn't, you know, I love branding. I'm like, well, we can't like call it anything that sounds like something else. And then Friddle came about. And you do what all business owners do, and you look to see if there's a trademark. You look to see online, and neither of those existed, so Friddle it was. And we actually, we really knew. See, I started business in 2012, so we knew in 2011 it was a good thing. I filed for the trademark before I even said the word Friddle.
Oh, my goodness, really? So you were really thinking ahead.
Yeah, I think if you have a consumer good and a lighthearted attitude and you like food or you like your idea or you like your name well enough, and I have no experience in that part of it, I think any good advice that I could give regarding something in your heart that you feel like is a really good idea or a really good name, I'm not saying be completely protective or paranoid about it like I was, but you definitely, you know, just see if there's a name, go get it, and it will serve you well.
And then you have it, right?
Yeah.
And then it can grow. So how did it grow from there? So you have the name, you had the product, and then what'd you do? How'd you push it on?
My first dollars were spent with a marketing company because I needed to class up. I didn't even know. I don't have that graphic design background. So I hired a company, Pivot Marketing, and they did some, they made the logo. It was a hand lettering. I've been educated. It's not a logo. But they hand lettered the word Friddle and helped me with the tagline.
Tell me a little bit more about Newfangled Confections.
So back, marketing strategy, back with the company. And we realized I was making a praline delivery to the Yatz restaurant on College and ran into someone, didn't know them, but they're a real big fan of the Friddle. And they saw me delivering the pralines, which is a creamy pecan-based candy. And they said, oh, it's Friddle. So there's Friddle in the pecans, in the pralines. And I thought, oh, no, there's not. These are just two totally different candies. But I realized at that moment that maybe Friddle, a product, should not have been the name of the company. And I didn't see that in the beginning. It's fine if you do it later and you're Mars. You can be M&M's. That's fine. But when you're starting at this scale, it's good to maybe see the entire company and not just the product. So back to the drawing board of now what do we call the company? And so we were pitched with Newfangled Confections, and I love it because confections means candy. And I remember sitting in the meeting where I was excited because I'm a positive, excitable person, but I didn't know what the word newfangled meant. But now I get it, and it's perfect, and it's wonderful, and I love it, and it's,
So it covers more than just Friddle. So that leaves open lots of possibilities then for the different products, like the pralines, right?
Yeah, it does. It allows us to bring in some seasonal stuff, and if it doesn't work out, we don't have to carry it to the next season. If it goes gangbusters, then we can do more permanent things with the packaging, like maybe we need to add a UPC, and maybe we need to pitch it to new stores, and maybe... I mean, so far, there's really nothing like the pralines and the Friddle, but we're just, you know, we're having a lot of fun with it.
So how has it grown? Did it grow beyond your original idea? Has it gotten bigger than you imagined, or were you seeing this all along?
No, I never saw this all along like this. I was what they call an extreme hobbyist. It's really like you got a business idea, you're going for it. A lot of, you know, it's always the luck meets opportunity. A lot of things were going your way or my way. But then I couldn't get past that extreme hobbyist move, which means you're selling a bunch, you're selling out. Well, I never realized till later you're selling out because you weren't prepared and you didn't bring enough. You know, it's like the idea that you sold all your candy is awesome. Well, maybe you didn't know what you were doing.
So it's not a good idea that you sold out.
Not in those cases. Okay. I mean, shows still surprise me. If I go outside of Indianapolis, we sell a ton of candy because there's nothing there. And I love the following, local following here, and I love that we're in almost everybody's neighborhood now in central Indiana.
So the planning has grown over the years. So planning and development and packaging changes and that sort of thing. Has there been things that have been particularly challenging over the years?
Yeah. You know, one thing that's challenging is being able to offer steady work for my extremely talented staff. Because how do you on one day say, hey, we're going to be busy. Are you available 80 hours? And then in a month, you have zero. I mean, it's never exactly zero. So that's been really nice in the growth is we can kind of see regular work that we can space out or we can put off in November, December and take those projects on in January, February. So I would say for any smaller business, that's interesting to see your own growth when you can offer steady work, which was part of my 3-tier goal in being in business.
Any advice that you would offer to people who have that idea, you know, the hobbyist with the idea or, you know, something that might be right on the edge of becoming an idea?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it is attitude, too. So the first advice is, I already know they're risky because they have the, well, maybe they're not if it's just an idea. Okay, maybe adopt a little bit of risk. Right? Because otherwise that thing is just in a box in their closet forever. Someone else is going to do it and then they'll wish they had. So have a little faith in yourself. Have a little risk. I can't stress this enough. I really think you should save some money. You don't have to save $500,000. But if you can say, I started at $1,800 and so far I've been really, really, fortunate in our process. But I would say even if you can just save like $5,000 or $10,000 and have someone making money in the house until you can get out of extreme hobbyist, flip the switch, and now, you know, that business is making money. We're close to that. But, yeah, it's just attitude, willing to take a little risk, be easy on yourself, know it's going to be hard work, figure out where your season is and how can you get prepared for that. Save a little money, and I don't want to sound negative on this, so that's my version of everything is going to cost more than you think.
We've been talking with Carrie Abbott of Newfangled Confections. You can find her products, including Friddle, at local stores and at newfangledconfections.com. Jolene Katzenberger, and we are back here on Eat, Drink, Indie Radio. Urban agriculture is a vital part of the local food movement and is key to bringing food closer to consumers. So we're talking today about indoor farming, and it's fascinating to see the growing operations taking place in Indianapolis in former warehouses and empty buildings where the big open spaces are being used to grow fresh greens, herbs, and vegetables year-round. John Shope of Falling Water Farm in Indianapolis tells us about his organic USDA-certified farm where he raises fish, which then provide nutrient-rich water for the herbs, lettuces, greens, and microgreens that he grows on tall shelves in a former warehouse space. John tells us about the farm, whose products are available to consumers through MarketWagon.com, how he switched careers from real estate to farming, and what's growing at Falling Waters Farm.
Falling Waters Farm. We're an indoor operation on East 34th Street, which is a few miles outside of downtown Circle, in a building that was constructed in the early 60s that needed some new breath into it. And we decided that we could build an aquaculture operation and in conjunction with that to grow fresh vegetables indoors.
Now, tell me what that looks like, because people might be imagining a big football field type of a farming operation just indoors, but that is absolutely not what's going on. It's not what we would imagine it farming to look like.
If you consider an indoor space to be a cubic space rather than a floor square footage, we try to get verticality out of everything that we do and maximize the efficiencies that we can use from every bit of cubic foot up towards the ceilings. So we have tall racks, we have LED lighting, which we designed here, and we try to grow as efficiently as one could possibly grow in a 20-foot tall space. We have levels, six different growing levels stacked on top of each other. Each one of those levels holds about 5,000 gallons of water. So there's a considerable engineering feat to do all of this and to move it all. So the namesake of the farm is Falling Waters. We pump it once up to the top, and then it tumbles down. So.
Oh, I get it. A very nice name, you know, and a very picturesque name. So what sorts of plants do you grow here?
Our plant selections are pretty widely varied. We have chosen to grow a few narrower banded items. We grow quite a bit of basil. We've grown an awful lot of kale, rainbow chard, and we grow a lot of microgreens within the building.
So there's a lot of water running through the whole system. How did you design this system with all these levels? This is a way, the very, very high levels of shelving with trays of tiny little plants growing in them. How did you design all that? Was that all a sort of a you-did-it-yourself sort of thing?
Yeah. We had help. We had advice. A good friend of mine and I sat back and calculated mathematically to make sure we weren't going to punch these things right through the floor when we got fully flooded. But our design started from let's see if we can do this on a small scale, and then as we started to try to utilize the square footage and the cubic footage that we were mentioning, we ended up deciding to put 12 inches of water all the way up to the ceiling. So 12-inch trays had to be calculated and structurally managed. And so, yeah, it was first the idea and then followed up with good math and support that and then followed up with good construction. And we did build them right here.
So this, the idea of this as a farm is just fascinating, but that's what it is. I mean, you have your own soil, you're building up your own compost. It's kind of a closed system, right?
Yeah, absolutely. We have a biologically alive system that does start with soil and compost, and then we, if it is to be a tower green grown out to maturity, the soil plug is placed into our hydroponic tower, and the towers then are filled with our nutrients from our fish room. So our only source of fertilizer is our fish production.
Well, now we have to talk about that too, because that's an integral part of the operation. So tell me about the fish room.
We have 180,000 gallons of production fish room, combined probably about 300,000 gallons on the farm. So our operation is very water-centric. We are feeding our fish, processing that fish water for optimal conditions for our fish, and as there's surplus water that comes off of the fish room, we use that water to replenish the nutrients. Nitrogen is the primary ingredient of that, but our nitrogen for growing in our towers comes from the fish room.
So this all works together, the fish, the plants, the water, the soil, you know, it's all right here under one roof. It's just fascinating.
That's correct. So we have special processes. What we are actually growing would be termed decoupled aquaponics. So a true household aquaponic system that you might set up in your basement or your garage would have continuously flowing water between the two systems that doesn't have the ability to separate. One is dependent on the other, but neither gets an ideal condition. So by raising the fish in a decoupled system from our plants, we can keep the plants in ideal zones, temperature, et cetera, and the fish in their ideal zones. So we get better production out of both by separating them.
Now, where do the products end up? Where do the fish end up? Where do the microgreens and the vegetables end up?
Our sales of our produce is primarily wholesale. We do a small amount of direct business. We're always looking for connections in that regard. Our Customers tend to be food service, restaurants, catering, and we do a small amount of our business through retail stores for our produce. Our fish are generally sold in larger batches, typically thousands of pounds at a time, and our fish are generally picked up here dockside, no pun intended, and are sold again on a live market. Typically, they're a tilapia that we raise, and that fish is generally held in high regard if it is still swimming and raised in the United States.
What do you see as the future of farming? Is this one type of future that we need to think more about, you know, when it comes to farming? Because you're right here in the middle of the city and can raise all this fresh produce. Is this where one way that we should be going?
I would absolutely agree. We have a variety of systems of growing food, and when we are reliant on outdoor production, we are susceptible to outdoor influences, whether that's drought or storms or any number of insects. And we can control most of those environmental conditions by being indoors and having a sealed environment. We do our best to keep pathogens that don't belong out. It is nature indoors, and so you do struggle with the occasional insect that finds its way in and you have to deal with, but indoors we can spot those things early and address them. Future of farming, we need a lot of different ways to grow food. We have too many people. We have specific dietary restrictions. By growing indoors, I can manage the inputs in a way that I know there are no heavy metals in our vegetables, as an example. So we get great flavor profiles. We don't have a lot of wind damage or direct sun damage after rain or any of those things that outdoor crops might suffer from. And really, we can manage temperature zones, ultimately seasons and number of days a year. So we get high output. Cycles per year are far greater than outdoor farming. I would say it's certainly one of the ways that we need to be growing food. There's really nothing wrong with all the other ways that happen as well, but absolutely closer to people, organically grown, is one of the ways we can win.
Now, tell me what your background is and how you got into doing this.
Well, let's see. That's a long question. I grew up mostly in a city. In seventh grade, my parents moved out to a farm outside of Ann Arbor. And I think that's where I began to take care of fish and learn about ecology and animals. We raised pigs and chickens and had horses, and neighbors had cattle. And you start to learn about a farming community at an influential age like that, and it really never leaves you. Obviously, graduating college, came down to Indianapolis and started a career with what I'd studied, which was commercial real estate, redeveloping commercial real estate. And in commercial real estate, you really learn about all sorts of different businesses where you meet interesting people doing all sorts of things, and it spawned ideas here and there of things I'd need to do one day when I grew tired of doing services related to redeveloping. So 2014, Thanksgiving, I came home, told my family I was going to be a farmer, and that was the initial conversation that started all of this. Then we built the farm in 2016 and began production really in 2017.
Now, where do you see it going from here?
Well, we're in a proof of concept stage, definitely still fairly small. We have 30,000 square feet or so under lights and 180,000 gallons of aquaculture water. So our production capacity is pretty significant. We're definitely not reaching a full capacity at the moment. We're enjoying the R&D that needs to happen at this early stage of a growth, and finding perfection in our stride. And as we do that, we expect to develop further systems and to expand as we need to into the right amounts of space or different towns and do more of what we're doing.
We've been talking with John Shope of Falling Waters Farm. For information, go to fallingwaters.farm or look for it on Facebook. Here on Eat, Drink, Indie Radio with more on indoor urban agriculture in Indianapolis. And that can take many forms. One type of indoor farming utilizes towers and hydroponic technology to grow vegetables, greens, and herbs vertically. Chad Brandenburg of Roca Farms in Indianapolis has taken a former grocery store building on Indy's east side and filled it with movable towers that are full of plants and seedlings. Imagine movable room dividers, like walls full of basil or mint or parsley. Chad tells us about Roca Farms, how the hydroponic system works, how he left the commercial lending business to become an urban farmer, and how he sees the business growing.
We are a hydroponic farm that utilizes hydroponic technology to grow food more efficiently and more nutritionally sustainably than can be done typically on a soil farm at this point. We use heirloom seeds and the powdered nutrient to grow all of the herbs and microgreens and things that we're growing right now.
Now, how do you grow it? So it's inside. We're in a former grocery store building. Mm-hmm. How do they actually grow? Kind of describe the structures they're growing on.
Sure. This is actually true vertical farming. These are vertical structures. They're called grow towers. They're 7 feet tall. The water comes through and drips from the top, runs down the medium, touching all the plants on the way down, and then gets recycled back into the nutrient tank. So we have no chemical runoff. We use about 5% of the water that a standard soil farm would use. Just keep everything really contained and, give the plants exactly what they're looking for.
So the fertilizing, the nutrients, that sort of thing, that's all in the water that's dripped through?
That's correct. Yeah, the nutrient level is called the EC, or electroconductivity, and that is the really fancy way of describing the nutrient component that is fed to the plants.
Now, what about the lights? You must control all of that as well.
Yeah, so we have the lights were designed with a specific spectrum in mind that the plants really like to mimic the outdoors. And we turn them on and turn them off based on, the grow times and things that we want the plants to have.
So what kind of plants are you growing here, and what kind can you grow?
Right now, we're focusing on herbs in the main grow area, and then we're also doing microgreens. But we can grow anything green and leafy, field crops, corn, soybeans, things like that. That we probably could, but not effectively, right? You could with a different system than we've chosen with the lights, but those are best left for soil farms. But anything, herbs, lettuces, we can grow. Peppers and those kinds of things here as well, our focus right now is herbs and microgreens.
Well, now tell me how they grow, because obviously they're towers, so they're kind of coming out and up, right?
Yeah, that's correct. We plant into the medium. The grow tower is put on a stainless steel table. We have the seedlings. The seedlings get put into the medium and then slid into the grow tower, and then it's put back into the vertical system. So the water drips in the top and runs all the way down. So we grow the seedlings, germinate first, then grow the seedlings in a seedling rack, and then the seedlings go into the grow towers.
So I'm imagining people might have in their head, we see the advertisements for in magazines, tomatoes that grow in a bag. You hang them and they grow up. You hang them on your wall out in your yard or something. So right. It's something people can imagine.
Yeah, absolutely. It's the technical term is tropism. So the plants are going to grow up towards the sun. In our case, up towards the lights. Although the lights are parallel basically to the grow towers, but the plants do come out and then kind of go up.
So a question, could you grow tomatoes this way?
In our system that we have here, no, but in a different system called a Dutch bucket system, you absolutely can grow tomatoes.
Okay, so this is just fascinating. I find that the idea of of a farm is, well, the concept is changing, isn't it?
It is. You know, where there's only so much arable land left. You have communities that are sprawling, urban sprawl. You have, you know, between farms and housing developments, a lot of the land is getting eaten up. So, you know, in a 10,000 square foot space here, I can grow roughly what a 250-acre farm could grow with 5% of the water that's used on the farm. So, I mean, all of those things, you know, when you look at it from a resource standpoint, I can do a lot pretty efficiently, effectively, and sustainably inside of a former grocery store.
And the whole idea of food deserts and getting food closer to people who need food, because you're right here in an urban area.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I was looking for a building that would fit, you know, this cause. And, you know, the old grocery store was great. The ceilings aren't super high. It's very large because indoors, it's controlled environment agriculture. You have to control the environment to be able to give the plants what they're looking for. So that's temperature, humidity, carbon dioxide levels, airflow, the lights, the nutrients. I mean, we literally are, you know, it's like our kids, right? We're in charge with giving them everything they need to prosper.
Now, how long does it take to get harvestable plants?
Germination, depending on what we're growing, is, you know, 2 to 4 days on the quick side. Some of the things take, you know, 5, 7, 10, depending on what we're planting. But most things are fairly quick, between 2 and 5 days. And then, so that's to germinate the seed, or, you know, get the plant to come out of the seed. And then they go in a seedling rack under their first set of lights to get to a point where we can then plant them in the larger farm. So between the germination and the seedling rack is about 2 weeks. And then in the farm, it's about 30 days until we have a harvestable product.
So now, where do these plants end up? Who's the end buyer for the product?
We started off with white tablecloth restaurants to go directly to the chefs. They're the ones that are most likely to appreciate the flavor, the smells, the product itself. But eventually, and it's what we're working on currently, is relationships and agreements with wholesalers and eventually retail, grocery, to really kind of be able to spread out.
So this is really one of the ways that farming is changing, one of the future paths for farming right here in the middle of the city.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we can provide very nutritious, sustainable food right here in the city. There's very little transportation cost. There's very little waste. Typically, if grocery store or a wholesaler, any of your large wholesalers, they're ordering product from California, from Mexico, from, you know, all over the place. As soon as that product is put on the first part of transportation to get here, that wholesaler owns the product. So the waste rate, the further away it is, the more of that product that's not going to be usable or sellable, but the wholesaler still owns it. So all of those things are huge benefits of finding a local grower like myself that can eliminate much of that cost and also provide a very sustainable and long-lasting product.
So what were you doing before you became an urban farmer? I guess that's what you would call it. You're a farmer,
absolutely,
right?
Urban farmer. I was a commercial lender for a large bank here in town and had been for about 16 years. I'd been with a couple banks, but I enjoyed that, but I was looking for something a little more personally fulfilling, something that I could, you know, really do to benefit my family and to also do good in the community. So I was looking for a different business opportunity and came across this, and it's been wonderful.
Now, do you have any sort of agriculture or farming background at all?
No, I don't. I started doing my research and due diligence, developed the plan, got a grant from Purdue to work with one of their professors for 40 hours. So Purdue provided funding for that professor. So I wound up with a gentleman in the School of Ag who had about 20 years of hydroponic experience. I had a plan. I had all my financials done. I had all my assumptions. I took it to him and said, destroy my plan.
And he looked at you're asking for him to shoot holes in it, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I need to know that the ship is seaworthy before we set sail. So he kind of looked at me funny. He said, I've never had anybody ask me to destroy their plan. Normally, it's helping me build it. Well, you know. So we worked together for that 40-hour period. And when we came out, some changes were in my favor, some were not in my favor, but all in all, it was still a very viable business. And he's actually a consultant with us as we're working moving forward. So
did you ever envision yourself as doing this, being a farmer?
Not at all. I went to law school and then was in banking and finance for a long time. No, that's not what I was thinking. But, you know, this isn't... put on a boots and hop on a tractor either farming. There's a lot of technology. There's a lot of things that are slightly different, but it's still a whole lot of fun every morning to get up, come in here and get to work.
We've been talking with Chad Brandenburg of Rocca Farms in Indianapolis. You can find Rocca Farms herbs and microgreens at marketwagon.com or look for Rocca Farms on Facebook. Jolene Ketzenberger, and you've been listening to Eat, Drink, Indie Radio on WFYI HD2 The Point. Thank you so much for tuning into our show today, and thanks also to our guests. Carrie Abbott of Newfangled Confections in Indianapolis, John Shope of Falling Waters Farm in Indianapolis, and Chad Brandenburg of Rocca Farms in Indianapolis. And thanks also to producer John Ketzenberger for helping to bring you Eat, Drink, Indie Radio. Eat, Drink, Indie Radio is powered by EatDrinkIndie.com. Eat local, drink local, eat, drink, indie.